This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we discover just how a local librarian lost 100 pounds, plus how a community can rally together to improve the health of its neighbors. But first, what is that new polio-like syndrome leaving some children paralyzed? Polio was eradicated in the United States in 1979. And the Global Polio Eradication Initiative has reported a 99% reduction in polio cases worldwide during the last two decades. But in the past 18 months, a rare and mysterious polio-like illness seems to have afflicted about 20 children in California, several of whom have suffered limb paralysis. Health experts are struggling to identify the cause. But here with more on this is Dr. Leonard Weiner. He's professor of pediatrics, pathology, and the division chief of pediatric infectious diseases at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Weiner. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So help us understand this. What do we know right now about this mysterious polio-like illness?
I think it is accurate to refer to it as polio-like because the presumed cause is a virus that is in the same family as polio, so-called the picornovirus family. Now, the cases in California, in a few instances, a causative agent called enterovirus 68 has been identified. This virus is, and the listeners should know this, is quite rare, but it does seem to be responsible for some, if not all, of this outbreak.
So let me just get this straight. The poliovirus is part of this family you mentioned, and that includes enteroviruses as well as the rhinovirus, which is really the common cold. But I read somewhere there are more than 100 different types of enteroviruses in the world that they've identified.
That's accurate, Linda, and in fact, what we deal with is frequent enterovirus infections that are not serious, maybe as the CDC estimates, 10 to 15 million cases annually in the United States, which, by the way, tends to affect children much more so than adults. And these are the common so-called summer colds or sore throats throughout the year that are due to these enteroviruses. Polio is part of that family. We have a vaccine that prevents polio, but we do not have a vaccine for the rest of the enteroviruses.
But as you said, most of these, really, some people don't even experience illness, or they just get mild symptoms like a runny nose or fever or maybe even a skin rash, but nothing as severe as what we've seen in California.
Absolutely true. And in fact, the other part of the family, the so-called rhinoviruses that you reminded us, really cause most of the common colds throughout the world.
So there are some enteroviruses in this 100 that can be more serious. I mean, you mentioned 68 was found to be part of this whole situation in California. What do we know about that virus?
We know that it's quite rare in the United States, and that's important for people to understand. But it does cause serious disease, or at least has the potential to do that. The CDC estimates that from 2000 on, there have been less than 50 documented cases that they know about for this enterovirus 68. And by the way, most of those were not associated with the kind of paralysis that's seen in this outbreak.
But they get things like viral meningitis, encephalitis. Right. Basically, it does involve the central nervous system.
Right. So some of these enteroviruses have the potential to do more in the way of infecting the central nervous system than the regular, usual enteroviruses.
And you mentioned there are others.
Yeah.
As
so
well.
So actually, there's an enterovirus called enterovirus 71, which has been found to cause more central nervous system infection worldwide than even this enterovirus 68. Enterovirus 71 is found in the United States. It's found right now and in recent years in Southeast Asia, where it's been responsible for meningitis and even paralysis cases like we're talking about in California. So enteroviruses 68, 71, occasionally some others, do have the potential to do what has happened in California.
Go ahead.
But it's also pretty rare. These are not really epidemics. These are just clusters of cases which have been found both in the U.S. and worldwide. And yes, they cause significant disease, or can cause significant disease. But parents and the population at large should not really get too worried about this outbreak. This is not going to spread throughout the country. This is not going to be like polio.
It's still a frightening thing, though, to see, you know, children basically become paralyzed. And I'm sure I was probably not alive, or no, I was alive during the polio outbreaks, but I was very, very young at that time when it was really rampant in this country before the vaccine was available. So I'm sure we all understand that it's a frightening thing to see that kind of thing. And people, it would be the kind of thing people would worry could spread.
And truthfully, some of the paralysis that has been noted in this California outbreak doesn't seem to get better. So the children recover, but they do not recover arm or leg weakness or full paralysis. And that's not too different than what used to happen with polio.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Leonard Weiner, and we're talking about the recent outbreak of a polio-like syndrome among some children in California. So when you talk about, are there other enteroviruses that are known to be this dangerous, or is it mostly the 68 and the 71 that you've described?
Many other enteroviruses can cause viral meningitis. In fact, it's probably one of the most common causes of viral meningitis, again telling us that this virus has the potential to involve the central nervous system. The difference there, however, is that that sort of viral meningitis tends to be self-limited. By that I mean that patients recover completely.
Oh, fully recover.
Yes.
What, if anything, is being done or can be done when you talk about these kinds of viral infections? I mean, obviously with the polio virus, a lot of work went into trying to come up with a vaccine that would prevent it.
Well, as you said, you know, we've essentially eradicated polio almost worldwide. The remaining cases for polio are in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria, and hard to reach places, often places where there's a conflict going on, because we do have an adequate vaccine if we can get it to those people. Enteroviral clusters of disease, even when they involve the central nervous system, like this outbreak in California, are very, very rare and tend to be self-limited. People, again, should not be worried that this is going to march across the United States.
But this idea of developing a vaccine at this point is not something that's being undertaken.
It would be very difficult to develop a vaccine for enteroviruses because, as you pointed out to the listeners earlier, there are over 100 types of enterovirus, and one vaccine would not cover all of those. You'd have to have separate components of vaccine for each of those types.
Which would be an enormous undertaking and extremely costly. And as what you're describing is that because there might not be the impetus because there aren't that many cases worldwide.
Probably vaccine development in other areas make more sense than trying to develop a vaccine against this specific enterovirus 68.
Do you worry, or I mean, in your experience in infectious disease, that a virus of this nature could change and become more widespread?
That's not the usual experience with enteroviruses.
So that particular family of viruses do not necessarily transform.
It's not like influenza, which can change its coat, so to speak,
regularly
and often year to year or even during outbreaks in a given year, these viruses tend to stay more stable. And fortunately, the ones that are responsible for neurologic involvement, particularly neurologic involvement with paralysis, are rare.
Is the CDC actually involved at this time, and what would their role be?
The California Department of Health encephalitis branch is leading this investigation, along with the children's hospitals where these youngsters were hospitalized and their viruses identified. The CDC is consulting. I know that's going on, but we should remember that this particular branch of the encephalitis branch of the California Department of Health is very experienced in this area, and they've had other outbreaks of enteroviruses, including outbreaks of 68 small numbers in past years where they've been able to identify that virus.
What do they do, though? Do they get involved in some way to limit transmission? I mean, is there some protocol in place to try to prevent its spread?
Certainly hospitalized cases are isolated, and in that setting we're able to keep transmission from occurring. Out in the real world, that's not so easy, because some people could have enterovirus 68 and have nothing more than just fever and a headache, and other people could catch it from them. Transmission occurs, and they could develop more serious disease.
So what determines that? I mean, is there some kind of predisposition that people might have, a lower immune system? Is it age-related? As you mentioned, that most of this hits children as opposed to adults.
Probably all of the above play a part. We don't really know the answer to that question. If we knew what made susceptibility to certain infections different from person to person,
we could win a Nobel Prize.
Right. We'd be a lot smarter than we are now, and somebody could win a Nobel Prize. But the truth is, it's never very clear why some get sicker than others. That was true in the polio epidemic. For every case of paralysis that was identified, there were studies that showed that there were almost 100 cases of patients who maybe just had fever and meningitis, temporary meningitis, bad headache, and they never went on to paralysis. So those are issues that are hard to answer. But in this case, I think, again, it's important to remind everybody of the rarity of this particular cluster of cases.
But while it's rare, do you think that this could have anything to do with the refusal of some parents to vaccinate their children?
I don't believe that this outbreak is related to that. But I think we have good evidence right now in real time in the United States that failure to vaccinate children has led to an increase of vaccine-preventable disease. And I'm sure your listeners know that in New York State, in the New York City area, and in the northern suburbs, there has been a significant increase in measles cases in children. And measles is a totally preventable disease by appropriate vaccination. Very safe vaccine, and yet these cases are occurring in children and young adults who were not vaccinated.
And there was a rise in whooping cough for the same reason.
And whooping cough is a very similar situation, and that's nationwide. And the measles outbreak is also not limited to New York, the West Coast, the Southwest. These are places where measles is on the increase.
So the takeaway in the little bit of time we have left is make sure you vaccinate your children.
Absolutely.
Because
on time.
We lose herd immunity. Our whole society loses immunity by those who are not vaccinated.
Yes. When we vaccinate the children, we're protecting everybody.
Well, thank you so much. As you said, it's very interesting, but I think your very key point is not to panic about this particular episode. My guest has been Dr. Leonard Weiner. He's professor of pediatrics, pathology, and the division chief of pediatric infectious disease at Upstate Medical University. Coming up next, how a local librarian shed 100 pounds in just a few months. You're listening to Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. If you're among the people who've got 100 pounds or more to lose, chances are you've already been on numerous diets and exercise programs without long-term success. So the standard advice, eat less, exercise more, and don't give up, often just isn't enough. Well, here with a true success story is Christina Pope. She's the Director of Health Sciences Library at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Christina. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So you've done what many consider the impossible. You have lost over 100 pounds. That is amazing.
Thank you.
Tell us about your journey. Tell us about it.
Well, I wasn't always overweight. And it's just, I think, one of those things that catches up with you as you get married, have children, get a job. And when I was younger, I walked to work, and I lived by myself, so my refrigerator was full of leaves and nuts and twigs and things like that. And I, you know, I went out a couple of times a week with my friends and everything, but I was pretty active. I never worked out, but I wasn't really sitting down a lot either. And then I got married, and, you know, we went out maybe more. And then I got a job where I had to drive to work and not walk to work. And then we had a son, and now we really had sit-down dinners every night because we thought that was really good for our son, and it was just a great thing for a family. And I was still driving to work, and then I began to work longer and longer hours. And I looked around one day, and it was Saturday, and I was at work.
Wow.
So here I was. I was getting up at 5 a.m. I was at work by 7, 5 days a week, and then I was working Saturdays and Sundays. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what am I doing? It's Saturday, it's Sunday, I'm at work. And I looked around, and I had a friend who had just lost a lot of weight. And I was like, wow, she can do that. I can do that.
So over how much time would you say it took you to gain that extra 100 pounds?
About 10 years.
So over a 10-year period, mm-hmm. slowly but surely,
yep.
you kept putting on the pounds through this kind of lifestyle mm-hmm. that you've been describing. And then besides the friend, did you have another wake-up call?
There were a couple. There was another friend who had put on a lot of weight, and I watched her, and she was literally growing out of her chair. And I thought, at work, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to buy myself a chair because I'm not today, not tomorrow, maybe not even next year, but if I don't do something, I'm going to have to buy a wider chair.
Wow.
And
were there also health issues? Did anything occur in your life? It sounds like you were still pretty young during this process, right. but did you find that there were any health issues that prompted your concern, like that kind of a wake-up moment?
So I'm 49, so I'm not that young. And no, I was very fortunate. My numbers might have been a little high, but I was all within the average, right? My cholesterol, my blood pressure, those were all still okay. It doesn't mean that if I had kept going on, they, you know, weren't going to be okay. But at the time, they were okay. You know, my family nagged me. You know, my mom, you know, honey, you're so fat. If you ever want to get another job, no one's going to hire you because you're so fat.
Mm.
My husband was really pretty good, but every once in a while he would say, you know, honey, I'm really concerned. I saw a psychiatrist, a food group,
you did
a nutritionist. Oh,
so
yeah.
So that's the question. What did, so you basically got to a point,
mm-hmm.
it sounds to me, like many people, mm-hmm. where you felt like something had to change.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, before you came to the actual successful route,
right.
tell us more about what you tried.
Well, I, as I said, I saw a nutritionist, And that was a disaster. And he told me I had an eating disorder. Happy to say I don't. When you go to the gym, you find a lot of people with eating disorders, and that wasn't what I had. But, you know, he kept telling me that. And it wasn't a good relationship. I felt very frustrated, you know, you need to eat these things, but I didn't feel like I was getting the tools to really eat those things.
So it wasn't helpful.
It wasn't helpful. And then I went to a therapy, like a therapy group, a group of women who just would get together and talk about
like
their concerns, a support group. Still had to pay for it. Insurance doesn't cover it. And I listened to their stories, but those weren't my stories. And I found it very difficult to relate to what they were saying.
So what, I'm trying to get to the core, so what was the silver bullet here? In terms of, I don't mean it was a silver bullet to lose all that weight. Nobody does it overnight. Mm-hmm. And I guess, how long did it take you to lose the weight?
About 7 months.
That seems like no time.
It was no time. And that, I was very fortunate.
Wow. Yeah. Well, so let's get, what was the trigger? To the point at which you decided, I'm going to lose a lot of weight.
Right. And that's hard to say, because even now, looking back, it's been almost 2 years, and looking back 2 years, I never can identify a trigger. What happened is I was talking with my friend who had just lost 100 pounds, and she was so excited. And she was, I've lost this weight. I feel really good. I'm like, how did you do it? She's like, I joined the Biggest Loser Challenge at the Gold's DeWitt Gym. And I'm like, oh, you know, I've seen that on TV. That looks really frightening. And she's like, no, it's a lot of fun. It's a great group of people. And she just kept, she was so excited about it. And I was like, well, you know, when's the next one starting? And she said, this weekend. And I left her office and I just thought about it. And I said, you know, if I really don't start doing something, it's not going to be good.
So the rubber met the road at that point.
The rubber, you said. Yes. And I left work early. I went over to Gold's and I paid in cash.
That's a helpful motivator.
Well, you know, I did it out of fear.
Yeah.
To some extent, because it was a lot of money. And I had tried all of these other things and spent, you know, a small fortune on a therapist and group therapy and all of these things, and nothing had worked. And I didn't want my husband to know that I had just plopped down a sizable amount of money if it wasn't going to work.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Upstate librarian Christina Pope, and we're talking about how she was able to lose 100 pounds, which is amazing, and keep it off. So you started with Gold's Gym. It took you only 7 months.
7 months.
That's almost frightening in a way to drop all that weight so quickly. What transpired?
Right.
What did you do?
So when you start with a weight loss challenge, they ask you what your goals are. And I really didn't know. I mean, well, of course, I wanted to lose weight. Who doesn't want to lose weight? When I was 249.7 when I weighed in. But I didn't really know what to do aside from eat less, move more. So I started into the challenge, and the trainer for that first challenge was Roger Markell at Gold, and it was interval training, but it was team-based. And so I had a team of about 13 people, and it was 3 times a week, and they expected you to be there because, you know, what you lost went to the team, and if the team lost weight, then you would win a prize.
So there was a lot of support.
There was a lot of support.
Teamwork support, almost a little community around this.
Fun. It was fun.
And it was fun.
You know, the humor was a little blue at times, but you could laugh. I mean, you were sweating bullets, but you laughed.
So it sounds like exercise, enjoyment of exercise,
yes.
The whole team approach, mm-hmm. the whole idea of community were crucial.
Right.
How about cutting down on food or your relationship to food?
Right.
Did that have to change?
Yes and no. You know, people ask me, why do you work out now? Oh, you look great, Christina. Why do you work out? And I'm like, well, I like to eat, so I need to work out. But what I was doing in getting to my 250 pounds is I pretty much starved all day. I fasted all day so I could go home and have a big meal with my family.
That's what you had been doing.
That's what I had been doing. So I would, you know, go home, have a big sit-down dinner, a glass of wine, And then I went to bed. And then I got up and I did the whole thing over again. And now I eat between 5 and 6 meals a day. And I'm eating probably the same amount of calories throughout the day, but it's spread throughout the day. So it's easier for my body to deal with. And that was hard because I was never a breakfast person. But now I really find that I really need to eat breakfast. And I don't like eggs. So I had to find breakfast foods or things that I could eat for breakfast that would power me up and get me through the day, but not be eggs. And I think one of the things that I had to accept is, you know, you don't have to eat eggs for breakfast. You don't have to eat cereal for breakfast.
Pizza for that matter.
You can eat pizza for breakfast this morning.
But the key point I think I'm hearing, though, is for you, these kind of multiple small meals throughout the day were really important to perhaps jumpstart your metabolism in a different way, or just overall you didn't have that. Maybe you didn't starve yourself to the point where you were then ravenous and eating large quantities only to sit quietly. So tell us a little bit, what is an average day? And I don't want to run out of time.
Sure.
Just tell us how you manage an average day in terms of currently.
Currently. So an average day actually starts on Sunday, because when you eat so many meals a day, you really have to plan. So I prep them on Sundays, just a whole bunch of veggies, and I put them in Tupperware containers with some protein. I love turkey, so I eat a lot of turkey. And then I just bring those into work. And so an average day then would be I would get up in the morning, have breakfast, cereal, yogurt, blueberries, and then I'll go to the gym. Then I'll go to work, have another little meal, around noonish, one-ish, another one around 3-ish, 4-ish, and then I go back to the gym 2 or 3 days a week, and I'll work out again.
So you would pretty much, on average, work out twice a day?
About four out of the 7 days a week, I'll work out twice a day.
What would you say, in a very little bit of time, is the key takeaway point? What's your advice to people? What's the main point here in terms of your success?
Right. You have to have fun. You have to find a group that you enjoy being with, and you have to keep it interesting. If I had to push the same piece of weight every day, I would have given up long ago. But I have several support groups. There's the No Boundaries people who run. There are the Blast people who do the cardio step stuff. There's the personal trainer. I take tap dancing class now at the JCC.
So basically be active.
Yes.
In your case, eat throughout the day,
small amounts,
mm-hmm. and have fun doing it.
Have fun.
I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Christina Pope. She's the director of the Health Sciences Library at Upstate Medical University, and she has lost over 100 pounds. That is amazing. Thanks for inspiring us. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. For our Healthy Eat segment this week, registered dietitian Maureen Franklin is here to tell us all about the DASH diet.
Hello. I thought it would be interesting to talk to people about the DASH plan because I think it's a very underused plan. The basic, what it stands for, is Dietary Approaches to Stopping Hypertension. And I think as we work with clients, people always know their blood pressure and they know the concerns about blood pressure, but a lot of times they don't know how to put it into perspective when you're talking about the diet. I find the DASH plan a very user-friendly diet. People can look at it. They can go on the website, the National Heart and Lung and Blood Institute, which is a wonderful website. There is a whole booklet on the DASH plan. It talks about the diet. It talks about the other important components to be heart healthy, about exercise, not smoking, maintaining your weight. The beauty of it, what I love, is it's basic food. It doesn't have to be gourmet food. It doesn't have to be something that you have to spend a lot of money on. It's just your basic food. The basic emphasis of it is more fruits and vegetables, which we all talk about and we all know about, more whole grains, which is the emphasis, less of your protein sources, more lean meats. It's not excluded, but it's saying try to eat less of it. fats, the good fats, the nuts, the seeds, the olive oil, the fruits and vegetables. We're really trying to make a big emphasis with that with the DASH plan. They tend to be very good for your content of potassium, magnesium, low in calories, high in fiber, and that's the other component. It's basically all your beautiful meal plans and your dietary approaches. It's looking at lower saturated fat. It's looking at lower fat. It's looking at higher potassium, as I said, magnesium, lean protein sources. It's just a great, great plan that I don't think people know enough about. And I think, as again, they don't tend to use it. One of the things I work with when I work with clients, they always ask me about menus. You can go on this website. It has a whole week's worth of menus. Wonderfully set up. Day one, what to do. Day two, day three. Then the other beauty of this is the component is based, again, we're talking about blood pressure concerns, trying to get your blood pressure under control or prevent hypertension. They have two different levels of a sodium restriction in this plan, 2,300 milligrams or 1,500 milligrams. So depending on where you are in terms of your medical situation, you can look and say, well, my doctor's a little concerned. He thinks my blood pressure is creeping up. You could pick the 2,300 milligram plan. Or if you already have high blood pressure on medication, always stay on your medication, talk with your doctor, but then say, well, maybe I need to try the lower level in terms of it. Is it difficult to follow? No. Very easy, wonderful, wonderful plan. So I encourage people to go on the website and to utilize it.
Next up, how to enlist one's community to promote good health for all. You're listening to Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air.
This is Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine with your Healthy Monday Minute for March 24th. Bite for the better. Sure, calories are an important part of maintaining or losing weight, but so are nutritious, healthy foods. Eating unprocessed foods like fruits, vegetables, beans, and whole grains increases your energy, lowers your risk of health problems, helps you maintain a healthy weight, and sets a good example for friends and family. This week, focus on making healthy food swaps at every meal. Replace your lunchtime serving of chips with crunchy carrot sticks, or start your morning with oatmeal and fruit instead of a bagel and cream cheese. You'll soon discover how delicious, nutritious foods can be. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, all healthcare institutions exist as part of a larger community, and as such, they have the responsibility to become an active partner in pursuing the health and well-being of the community it serves. Well, Upstate Medical University is no different, and here with more on some of the ways the university intersects with the Central New York community is Mozart Gurrier. He's a social worker and a community engagement specialist for the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and he also serves as the Healthy Neighbors Partnership Coordinator. And Maxine Thompson, she's Assistant Vice President in the Office of Diversity and Inclusion at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maxine, tell us about Upstate Medical University and the way it's actively engaged with the Central New York community. Okay. Tell us about the different ways.
I'd be happy to. Upstate has a long-standing history of being involved and a part of the community, particularly as it relates to the students. I'm a social worker by background as well, and we've always had a wonderful working relationship with Syracuse University. We've been a field placement site for many of their students who want to learn how to engage in a medical setting. We've worked very, very closely with a number of community agencies, especially those that serve the needs of our patients, whether they've been hospitalized or they're coming in as outpatients. So we've always had wonderful working relationships with many of the nonprofits and serving different segments of the population. We also are the primary care provider for the Onondaga Nation. So our reach is very, very broad. It's not just this immediate community of Syracuse proper, but we actually have a very strong presence presence at the Onondaga Nation. We've also, over the years, fostered some really good working relationships with the Urban Pastors Coalition, trying to really have a presence and connection with the urban residents here. We have a very strong connection with what we're calling the Healthcare Initiatives for Community Inclusion, which is really a partnership that works with many of the refugees and immigrants into our community. So we're very proud of that relationship as well. We have a very, very good working relationship with La Liga, which works with the largely Hispanic community, as well as with partners such as Synergy, where we're working with youth. You know, we're even working in the elementary schools. We have our students are very actively involved in working with young people, trying to provide tutoring services and being good role models. We've sort of adopted Martin Luther King School for many, many years. So being involved with the community is really nothing new for Upstate. It's part of our social responsibility and something that we're very pleased and proud. Not only our employees are involved, but our students is something as part of our mission.
Talking about the mission, what exactly is the mission of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion?
Okay. Well, the Office of Diversity and Inclusion is primarily in place around workforce initiatives. We want to make sure that our workplace is reflective of the communities that we serve. So that means that we put a particular emphasis on diversity, you know, wanting to make sure that we have the various ethnicities represented here, people from various religious backgrounds, people with disabilities, people with veteran status. You know, we want our workforce to mirror the communities that we're here to serve. So that's very important. That's one of the important roles that we do have is looking at the workforce. We're also concerned about the students, making sure that they have suitable role models that they identify with. We recognize that the future, as the demographics are changing, you know, the workforce and our physicians of the future are going to look different than what they currently look like now. So we want to be able to nurture them, bring them in, give them appropriate role models, and keep them on track. So that's a piece of what my office does.
So you've really, I mean, you've outlined very, mm-hmm. very eloquently a lot of different initiatives that mm-hmm. Upstate has been engaged in, mm-hmm. in a broad sense in terms mm-hmm. of really interacting with the larger community. Mm-hmm. But there's this thing called the Upstate's Health Advocacy Program, which mm-hmm. I'm particularly interested in
okay.
because it's a way, actually, that Mozart, I know, is a spinoff. Your program's a spinoff of that. And I want to talk more about that. What is this concept of a health advocacy program? What is that?
Okay. Well, let me back it up just a little bit.
Sure.
What we wanted to do, because we have such a rich history of community involvement, we thought that we needed to do a better job with our closest neighbors, which happens to be Pioneer Homes, part of the Syracuse Housing Authority. And an interesting fact is that Pioneer Homes is one of the first public housing units in the nation. So, and they're right in our backyard, or we're in their backyard, so to speak, because they were there first. So we've kind of felt and have felt for years that we should be better neighbors and we should be more engaged with the residents of the Pioneer Homes and Syracuse Housing Authority.
And they've been around a long time. Aren't they celebrating something like a 25th anniversary or
actually
something?
Actually, a 75.
75?
They've been here for
oh,
75
my.
Years.
My.
Yes, the oldest public housing unit in the nation.
Wow.
So it is a big deal. And many of the residents have been there, you know, spent their entire lives living in this particular housing authority. So there's going to be a really big gala coming up on April 4th. It's going to be huge, you know, at the Ahn Center to really celebrate the longevity of the housing authority, but also to recognize many of the incredible talents that have come up through public housing.
So tell us about the advocacy program, though.
So, so what we wanted to do was, as part of our reaching out and being connected with Pioneer Homes is we went out there. You know, we actually hired Mozart as our community engagement specialist, and this came out as a result of the Upstate Leadership Academy. They actually did a needs assessment. They did some of the groundwork for us, did a needs assessment, identified some issues that the residents themselves felt were very important and ways that they would like to see the relationship with Upstate develop. And so then we took that to the next logical step. We created, a real proposal. including a job description and what this person would do and what we envisioned the person would go out into the community to implement. And it got supported through the Upstate administration and funded. And so we actually hired somebody that was, we feel, was a stellar hire, uniquely qualified to lead this initiative.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's Health Inc. on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Maxine Thompson and Mozart Gurrier, and we are talking about Upstate's Health Advocacy Program. And Mozart, that's the segue right into you. You are the great new hire.
He is.
Why are you here? What are you doing? And tell us about your program.
So the Resident Health Advocate Program is based on a model out of Boston University. They've been working with families and people that live in public housing for the last 10 years, sponsored by the Center for Disease Control, the federal government. And so we adopted their model and became affiliates with them. And the basic ideal is that the folks that live in public housing, if we utilize their leadership skills and their leadership abilities and their connections in the community, that we might have a better chance at preventing some diseases that can be managed by lifestyle choices, whether it be exercise or nutrition, or whether it be information. And so the Resident Health Advocate Program allows residents to learn amongst residents that already live there, as opposed to healthcare professionals. The healthcare professionals actually act as advisors, and we had a number of faculty members, as well as Maxine, as well as folks from the community, who trained the residents to become resident health advocates so they can go out and train their neighbors.
That's fascinating. It's a great concept. So in other words, your neighbors become informed, mm-hmm. and your experts, so to speak, and then they can help you learn how to take better care of yourself. So then you can basically forestall the possibility of developing long-term chronic diseases and that kind of thing. So diet, nutrition, exercise, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. And also community concerns. So sometimes there's issues of safety, and sometimes there's issues of, you know, family support. And so the community health workers or resident health advocates are out in the community really listening and paying attention. And so I think that has been the benefit of the program, is that we get to sit down with people and listen to what they have to say about what their day-to-day lives are, and see if we can provide structures that allow them to live better lives.
So in your experience, I mean, this is a Boston University model. What is there research, Maxine? Is there something that supports the use of a resident health advocate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We looked at a lot of the literature, and the research has really demonstrated and shown us that residents of government-sponsored housing units typically have shown much higher incidence and rates of poor health outcomes based on some of these chronic disease entities that you've already mentioned, whether it's hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, dental disease. These are things that do have some kind of a preventive model to it. And so the research has shown that tapping into the residents themselves has been very effective in intervening and addressing some of these healthcare disparities. The residents have been very successful in developing rapport and the relationships with their peers. And so they can do things that professionals can't, just because we don't have the ability to kind of, you know, there's a trust factor that still has to be overcome.
And there's also resource, you know, limitation in resources. But I think your point is very well taken, that you'd be much more apt to take it from your neighbor and friend, mm-hmm. than a strange person coming in who doesn't really know you, the uh-huh. community, and all of that.
Right, right. So it's a win-win kind of situation, because it does afford us the ability to get to know our neighbors better. One of the things that one of his techniques has been to really go on a listening tour. You know, he has been in the neighborhood. He has knocked on the doors. He has spoken to every single resident.
Wow.
He has sat in their living rooms. They talk to him one-on-one. So we've gotten, you know, we've got real, legitimate, validated areas of concern that we're able to go in and, you know, through the health residents advocates, be able to develop interventions that, again, are resident driven. We're not trying to come in and impose our values on them. We're looking at what they're identifying as issues of concern,
their needs,
and using it in a method that is more acceptable and appropriate, you know, given the nature of the setting.
So Mozart, in your listening tour, what did you find? What do you think the major challenges that these residents face, or in terms of their health concerns?
I think many of the challenges that they face are the same challenges that all Americans face, is managing diet, is finding time to exercise, and all these types of things, managing life, you know, and managing, you know, taking care of yourself. And so the resident health advocates, as well as the Tenant Association, as well as Syracuse Housing Authority, which has been an incredible partner, act as kind of facilitators of making sure everything works smoothly and that it's actually a great neighborhood where having an academic medical center as your neighbor is the best possible neighbor you might have.
So they can access resources and stuff through the medical center. I'm wondering, does something like, do they also offer, let's say, within the housing, an exercise room, a place where people can go and really make use of that opportunity for exercise?
Yeah, we've collaborated with the YMCA before, and we've hosted Zumba classes there.
Wow.
And we actually had an opening of our internship element of the Resident Health Advocate Program. The YMCA provided us with a number of free passes for families so that they could go and exercise together at the downtown YMCA.
So overall, how long have you been involved yourself?
About a year.
So in this year, what have you seen as the greatest stumbling blocks or the greatest achievements?
I think the greatest stumbling block is there being so many great ideas, honestly, and how to kind of manage all those great ideas and organize them in a way that really works. And I think one of the greatest gifts has been that we found a lot of people, both at Upstate in terms of folks from the HR department, as well as our clinical staff, as well as our academic staff, as well as people in Pioneer Homes who have really stepped up to the plate and said that they want to be leaders. And so leaders and collaborators have been popping up from the county to Upstate to all across the community. And so it's really been exciting to have so many opportunities to make a difference.
And I can't emphasize enough that this truly is a partnership. That's one of the things that I think has been the most exciting piece, that it has, you know, we started off not, as I mentioned earlier, not wanting to impose, but really to be a partner. And it's just been wonderful to see the relationships develop. And as Mostar said, the ideas just keep percolating. We're not going to have any shortage of people willing to step up to the plate.
Well, this is wonderful news and a wonderful program. I want to thank you both so much for coming in. My guests have been Mozart Gurrier. He's a social worker and community engagement specialist for the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and Maxine Thompson. She's assistant vice president in the Office of Diversity and Inclusion at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. There is a self-destructive behavior called cutting, a form of self-harm in which the sufferer, often an adolescent, makes small cuts on his or her body, usually with a knife or a sharp object. The behavior puzzles and frightens parents, and usually intensive therapy is needed to help the patient understand his or her motivation and how to stop it. Ithaca poet Oliver French is also a psychiatrist. His powerful poem, Cutting, juxtaposes two kinds of mutilation with a knife. One is approved, one is not, but each incident occurs without anesthesia, and the poem answers our question of why someone wants to be cut and to feel. Cutting, by Oliver French. I heard a guru say, I had a surgeon remove my scar. Do not, I said, freeze my skin, for I know that if I only bring my mind's blade to the wound, my body shall feel no pain. Your blade cannot exist where mine has precedence. He protested, but he cut, and as I predicted, I felt no pain, while my mind held only its own blade. I heard a young girl say, my mother offers me her love if only, then withdraws into the drugs that keep her love imprisoned. I know I can forget her when I carve a long line on my forearm with a blade. I love to see the blood spurt out. It doesn't hurt because the blade cancels and is canceled by the pain I feel when mother cuts the loving bond she almost promised. Thank you.
you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we examine whether nurse practitioners should be able to practice without a doctor's supervision. Plus, we'll find out all you need to know about gynecologic cancers. And we'll meet some local competitors who are preparing for the Corporate Challenge Championship race in London. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.